and switcheroo.
sorry about that. Stay tuned for Worst Foot Forward, an encyclopedia of heroic failure. Join host Ben Vanderveld and Barry McStay and their esteemed guests as they brandish their wooden spoon of destiny and celebrate the losers, heroic failures, and spectacular missteps of pockmarked human endeavor. You can find them at worstfootforward.libsyn.com, on Twitter at worstfoot, or email them worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. This episode is Carl Donnelly talking about the world's worst coffee, because of course I would play the episode about coffee. And now, your feature presentation.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week hunts down the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week there are two possible versions of this week's episode, instant and artisanal. In the instant one, you just pour 300 millilitres of boiling water over my co-host until he loudly bellows his suggestion at you, and you go away perked up but unsatisfied. Alternatively, you can have the artisanally made, ethically sourced, perfectly brewed and karmically aligned episode, complete with syrup, steam and a tiny biscuit, where we source the smuggest hipster trivia available and deliver it to you with an air of pitying disdain that you'd even darken our doorstep to ask for it. Or you could just have a brew and a scone. Your choice. And with me is the Vente to my Grande, the triple shot to my chocolate-covered froth, and the global tax-avoiding behemoth to my plucky local shop, Barry McStay.
Peek behind the curtain for our listeners. Ben and I both thought we were writing the intro for the show this week. I had also written, and with me is the Vente to my Grande. Completely independent of each other.
Oh, yeah, of course. God.
We are so in sync. You're a coffee drinker. You've got a posh coffee machine and everything.
I do have a posh coffee machine. Well, when me and my wife got married, on the wedding list, you go like stuff that is boring and we're going to need and then people can buy last minute, and like the stuff that we'd quite like. And then there's the stuff that's like the jackpot prize at the end of a game show that you're like, who really loves us enough to buy that? And it turns out no one loved us enough to buy us the coffee machine. So the person that loved us enough was us.
It was my mum's friend from Switzerland who loved us enough to get us the really nice copper angle poise floor lamp.
That is definitely a tax dodge. No two ways about that.
Let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a comedian and podcaster, because we're nothing if not original, and who's been nominated for the Edinburgh Comedy Award twice. It's just nice to be nominated, I'm sure he would say. He's appeared on many TV shows, including Mock the Week and Russell Howard's Good News, and travelled the world performing at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and the New Zealand Comedy Festival. Montreal, Melbourne, New Zealand, places with a good sense of humour and adequate public health policy during pandemics. Two Vegan Idiots is the podcast that he releases weekly alongside with his comedian co-host Julian Dean, where they track through the week's events with a comedian guest. Two Vegan Idiots sounds a lot like a crossword clue, so answers to the Worst Foot Forward postbox, please, listeners. And in 2017, our guest and his podcast partner Chris Martin, not that one, started a spin-off podcast called Babysitting Trevor, which has since gone on to be runner-up at the 2018 British Podcasts Award Best Comedy Podcast category, but it's just nice to be nominated. The show sees him and his co-host try and drag their eccentric Australian third member, Trevor Cook, into the 21st century with hilarious consequences. Except Trevor took one look at the 21st century, saw how it was going, and said no thanks, and returned to the 20th century, or as they call it in Australia, the 19th century. Please welcome our guest, Carl Donnelly.
Hello, guys. How are we?
And with a voice like that, how could he not host two podcasts?
Exactly. My voice isn't as good as this mic makes me sound. Generally, it's pure tech.
Ben and I are both like Joe Pasquale in person.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do think I've got quite a deep voice. I often have any time I've done radio, the producers always have a bit of an issue trying to make it. They sort of think, oh, it's got boom, it's too boomy. So they keep trying to fiddle with things, trying to make it sound slightly more acceptable. Bye.
The thing is, now talking, when you've gone a little bit quieter than you were when we were warming up, and you're in like snooker commentator / golf commentator.
John, oh, what's his name? Peter
Alice.
Sadly passed away, didn't he? What? Yeah. It's a sad start to a podcast. Yeah.
But hey, think of this episode as your audition to be the new voice of golf cart.
I would love, because I play golf. I've played golf. I played when I was a kid a lot, and then I stopped for years because I became a teenager and golf is rubbish. And then when I was sort of, I got to like late 20s, and was a full-time comedian, I had some free time on my hands, started up again. And I would love to be a golf commentator, because Peter Alice, like, most of it wasn't about golf. Do you know what I mean? Because there's so much in-between time. Yeah. But you'd find him just looking, sort of telling you about his holidays and that. And I think that's the dream of being a sports commentator, where you can just fill time.
What I'd like to see people, what I'd like to hear people do is take, because that's true of golf and of snooker and of cricket, and what they should do is just cut the bits where they waffle on in between shots and balls and put them into different sports and see whether the listeners can tell the difference.
But you don't want something like football where like there's lots happening for just 90 minutes. You want something like golf where the competition lasts 4 days and there's only 3 shots that really matter, and then you can just eat cake, drink tea, and talk about the birds you're looking at.
Well, the bird, yeah, Peter Ellis was always going on about the birds. Anytime there was a water sort of hazard, he'd always be talking about, oh, what a lovely family of
it's like jazz commentary
there.
it's what's happening around the actual sport that you're meant to be commentating on.
I love it.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world, Carl. Clearly you're good at being the voice of golf.
I would love that.
What are you not so good at?
I was actually gonna say I had a couple of different ideas, but when you said, you know, you did my biog when we did, is something happening? I just felt something vibrating. I realised my my Fitbit was just telling me I'd hit 10,000 steps.
You're sat in the chair.
Sitting down. I think I moved my arm. I was very close and I moved my arm. But I was going to say, because I've been runner-up at a lot of things in my life.
Just nice to be nominated.
It is nice to be nominated. But I would say one of the things I'm worst at is being professional and actually getting over that finish line to actually do it. I'm good at getting near, but I reckon I've got it out of my system in the last couple of years, so I've really grown up and now I've got a kid. But I used to be very self-destructive, and my ability to like snatch a loss from the jaws of victory was like second to none.
What you're saying is that in golf, your short game is appalling. Just smash it off the drive.
I can literally drive it near the green, and then I'm going to put it through the green with a lofted wedge. You know, nice. Just going to be so. Yeah, I think I'm pretty. I've made some bad errors in my career. I've had a little sniff of like somebody's gone, right, we want you to do this, and then I've gone yes, and then I've just messed it up so badly that it's like, we won't be working with you anymore. So not in a moral or ethical way, just a lack of professionalism.
That is the most confessional answer we've had to that question in a while. So clearly, like, lockdown has tenderized you.
I'm also really bad at cleaning, if you want that one. That was the other option, genuinely. I'm not, like, even the coronavirus was not a good time for me. It's like having to clean stuff and I'm tidy, but underneath is a layer of dirt. I'm so bad at clean. Like, I'll do the bare minimum to clean something and then just ignore it and hope there's no germs.
It's the problem. You're going to these pitch meetings, like throwing paper everywhere, scrawling on the walls, taking a pee in the water cooler, and then worst of all, not cleaning up after yourself.
I used to have a cleaner, genuinely, because even though I live in, like, me and my wife live in a flat that is small enough that it's so easy to clean, but she just got so annoyed with me. Just, you know, she'd watch me cleaning and it was like, you're not doing it. Literally, it's almost like you're pretending to clean, which is still as much hassle as cleaning, but for some reason I've got this mental block that I just can't, like, the thought of actually like cleaning a window is like, oh, shut up. I'll just not do that forever.
I can think of the perfect job for you then. People don't want to work with you, but you could be like an extra in Harvey. Oh, yeah. Or just always pretending to clean windows in the background.
Don't want to seem like an old-time comedian slagging off his wife, but I have learnt in the few years of living in the same house as my wife that it is possible to both clean things incorrectly, do the washing up incorrectly, and even load a dishwasher incorrectly. Our other guests are nodding as well, and it's like following... I feel like I'm being followed around by an angry caddy at all times.
Oh, anyway. And that's a bad miss.
Yeah. Before I incriminate myself further for the alimony proceedings that will inevitably follow me in 5 to 10 years' time, we should introduce our other guests this week. Because this week we have a couple of Patreon supporters who have joined us. They are $10 a month supporters, which means that they are allowed to both choose the topic of this week's show and act as judge, jury, and executioner at the end of the show. And they are a first on the show. We haven't just got one Patreon supporter, but two. We have the dynamic father and son duo of David and Tyler Harrington. They live on Fox Island in Washington, which sounds both delightful and fictional.
Loud at night.
Yeah. Absolutely horrifying at night. Tyler is an impending high school student at the Science and, it says here, Math Institute, but I'm afraid I am going to have to correct you. It is Maths, gentlemen, and I know because we invented the language. That is in Tacoma, Washington, and he looks to study marine biology and save the whales, sea stars, penguins, and the lot. I mean, I admire your ambition, Tyler, but look, just settle for 1 out of 3. Go for the penguins, mate. They're a long way off. No one will bother them. Dave is an environmental and software engineer building software that helps water companies save water, paper, money, and time. Again, mate, 1 out of 4 will do. Dave spent 6 years of his childhood in Britain and has corrupted Tyler properly with an appreciation for Monty Python, Danger Mouse, and sausage rolls. Ah, at last, 3 out of 3, the Holy Trinity. It is a delight to welcome our judges for this week, Dave and Tyler Harrington. Hello, chaps.
Greetings, gentlemen. Great to talk to all of you.
Oh, it's great to have you. And you're based in Washington, the home of one of the behemoths of coffee that we might get onto.
Yeah, we're not regulars of that particular chain, so we'll keep that on the down low, but that's all right.
Don't worry, it's our job to slag them off. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Also, Tyler, can I just check, if you're in impending high school, how long until you'll be a fully qualified marine biologist?
Roughly? Ooh, 8.
Okay.
Eight.
So how long, how many whales, sea stars, and penguins do we think are still going to be around in years?
We're going very dark very early.
We are, yeah. Also, have you seen the news, pal? Also, I mean, I thought you were going to say there, Barry, 8 years to be a marine biologist. I don't think there's going to be much of the ocean left.
Oh, there'll be lots more than there is now.
Oh, shit, no, it's increasing, isn't it? Yeah, sorry, I forget how climate science works.
In fact, that's brilliant, Tyler. You're coming into a growing industry.
Need to satisfy a hungry mind? Every week, Your Brain on Facts brings you science. Why does mint feel cold? History. King Charles II of Spain was so inbred, his family didn't bother educating him. Music. Many hit songs and even entire albums were written for revenge. Technology. The first video game was made on an oscilloscope in 1958. And every other topic under the sun. Look for Your Brain on Facts on your favorite podcast app or at yourbrainonfacts.com.
What country does coffee originate in?
Ethiopia?
Ooh. Yeah, I didn't know that. First up, Irish, drink lots of tea, don't drink any coffee. But I didn't realise it originates in Ethiopia. According to legend, a 9th century goat herder called Kaldi in the region of Kefa discovered the coffee plant after noticing the energising effect it had on his goats.
Lovely.
Yeah, which that is a story that did not appear until 800 years later, but you know,
if you found they had one after 4 p.m. they just didn't sleep a wink that night.
Yeah. That's why they needed a nanny to look after their kids.
Unbelievable.
The two professional comedians are rolling their eyes at me. Annoyingly, our guest judges have themselves politely muted at the moment, so you couldn't hear the gales of laughter that were definitely coming from them. The first coffee to arrive in Europe probably came through the Republic of Venice because they did a lot of trade with North Africa and Egypt in the east. But in the 1500s, when they were sort of first importing it, a lot of Christian Europe didn't think it was it was very holy to drink it. They called it Satan's drink. They called it a Muslim drink. They urged Pope Clement VIII to outlaw it. And the Pope said the drink was so good, it would be a sin to only let pagans drink it. Which sounds very much like the church in general is going, this is bad, but we like doing it. So we'll make that a thing we can do.
Yeah. He's just sipping his espresso going, I'm not banning this, I'm afraid. It's
oh, yeah. And you know the Pope drinks an espresso with the one finger stuck out as well.
Of course. Yeah. Yes.
Well, because the papal slippers are like little sort of turned up at the end with pompons on. So I can imagine Pope Clement drinking that and then the toes uncurling because the coffee is so good.
The Europeans were really... This is one of those things, a bit like when we talk about World War II, Ben. The Europeans were trying to like be the first nation to have the first coffee bean so they could sort of control trade and have access to it. And there was won. The race was won by the Dutch in 1616. A guy called Peter van der Broeke, who was a Dutch merchant, managed to steal some from a coffee bushes in Mocha in Yemen. And he took them back to Amsterdam and put them into the botanical gardens there. He got them sort of 40 years ahead of anyone else in the rest of Europe.
I was thinking this the other day. I was reading about the Spice Wars, and obviously because the Dutch went off to the East Indies to get everything. This morning, my son asked for some cinnamon on his porridge. And as I poured it over, I was like, 400 years ago, this would have made you an absolutist monarch. And now you're just like a slightly bourgeois young kid from South London. Like, the role of cinnamon has really changed.
Yeah. where's the world's largest coffee producer?
Oh, I don't know.
I've got Kenya. The top 10 here. Kenya is not in the top 10.
Is it not?
No, Ethiopia's up there, but not Kenya.
I'm going to say...
Colombia.
Colombia's third. Good okay. work. David's waving a hand. Go on, David. Do you have a guess for us? Go on, let's have a guess from our judges, just in case.
It was going to be somewhere South American.
You're right.
We were going to go Costa Rica, but there's not a ton of land.
No, so Costa Rica's a bit small.
Peru. Only so much you can get out.
It's Brazil. It's the big one.
I wanted it to be Paraguay because no one knows anything else about Paraguay. Like, what are they doing there? Just shitloads of coffee.
Brazil exports over 44 million bags of 60 kilograms of coffee every year, which is second on the list is Vietnam, and they do 27 Ooh. Million. So Brazil is like 17 million more bags a year.
I would not have expected Vietnam to be number two. Also, I imagine after in the 60s and 70s, after America dropped all that napalm on the forests, everyone must have been awake for decades.
I thought you were going to do an orange mochaccino joke, Ben, which is very bad.
Luckily, our American judges high-fived that, and we're kind of like, we have grandfathers who are veterans. How dare you?
We're not proud of that. We don't want to take that on. Sorry.
Okay. but Brazil coffee's not native to Brazil. It was first introduced in the 18th century. So, but they sort of under Portuguese rule, they sort of tried to soup up their coffee production. But French Guiana, their neighbor, was the big like coffee producer in South America at the time, and they refused to share any of their coffee seeds. And there's a story that there's a lot of theft in coffee, it turns out. A guy called Francisco de Melo Paleta was sent to French Guiana on a diplomatic mission. And while he was there, he seduced the wife of the governor of French Guiana and got her to give him a bouquet of flowers with some coffee beans hidden inside it.
How is this not a film? Surely that is a... That's got to be a film in the waiting.
Yeah, coffee is one of the most commonly stolen goods in piracy, even today as well. It was back in the golden age of piracy, and even now there's still coffee stolen a lot because it's exported in large amounts and it's quite expensive.
Really? But obviously in the golden age of piracy, they had enormous galleons with holds where you could store coffee, whereas now, as I understand it, it's all little dinghies in the Straits of Yemen with AK-47. So where are they storing the coffee?
A lot of piracy.
It's all just coffee pods now, isn't it? Yeah. It's much easier to steal.
In shots, yeah. apparently a lot of piracy now takes place on land, which is very sad. It's not the same.
That's not piracy. I'm sorry, I'm not having that.
But they because coffee is grown in largely mountainous, remote regions, they can hijack things on the road. You can digital piracy is a real thing. They re-divert or they reroute shipping containers filled with coffee to put them on, to get them on different ships or sent to different locations. So,
oh, is that why my packed order didn't turn up last week?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. But yeah, no, Brazil is still, as I said, a powerhouse in coffee. In the 1840s, they were producing 40% of the world's coffee. By the 1920s, 80% of the global output of coffee. Ooh. It was basically keeping the entire country's infrastructure afloat. But because of that, they were producing so much, they were then burning loads of stockpiled coffee to keep the prices buoyant. There was so much coffee in the world that Brazil's entire infrastructure was basically it rose and fell with coffee. If coffee prices dropped, Brazil was in trouble. So they were burning in 1 year 78 million bags of stockpiled coffee to try and keep the price of global coffee high. And because that didn't help, they were the ones who asked Nestle to create instant coffee. So the reason we have instant coffee today is the Brazilian government needed, you know, a different way of producing coffee that didn't require beans being kept fresh and all of that, so they could regulate the flow of it. So yeah, they, in 1937, a scientist called Max Morgenthaler invented instant coffee using dried coffee extract, and they began producing it the following year, and that's where Nescafe comes from. So an entire country's infrastructure relies on your black coffee of a morning. Okay, biggest coffee producers in South America. Where's the biggest coffee consumption? And the USA is only 25th on the list.
Oh, right. Wow.
Okay, who is the most alert nation on Earth?
Germany.
You're in the right sort of area, Northern Europe. It's the Scandinavia, all the Scandinavian countries.
Scandinavia.
But, annual consumption of coffee is about 4.4 kilos per person.
Yeah.
Christ almighty. I reckon that's all in the summertime months. Like, when the sun never goes down, you're like, I've just got to be awake at all times.
Apparently Finland is top of the list. Coffee's so popular in Finland that there is a government-mandated 10-minute coffee breaks per day in Finland.
Norwegians, they're really chilled. They're really calm people, the Finns. Yeah. Like, very chilled.
They're very watchful.
Yeah. But also, because I remember going to when I went to Helsinki, that Helsinki Jazz Festival is like a world famous jazz festival, so they're underrated hipsters, the Finns.
Oh, like Scandinavian. Yeah, in terms of coffee, I dabbled in some Scandinavian beans in my time. And they really know what they're doing, but I didn't realize it was like the epicenter of coffee drinking. I just knew that they, you know, they're much more cool and trendy than you think they're all walking around just in like snow boots.
Yeah, no,
nice.
In Denmark, they often have coffee breakfasts or coffee wedding receptions. And in
that's too hipster for me.
Yeah,
I'm a coffee lover, but a coffee wedding breakfast, that is, it's not
also,
for me. Thank you.
White dress, spill the coffee. It's day's ruined. Day's absolutely ruined. And in Iceland, I realized this. I didn't realize this. Prohibition was in place in Iceland between 1915 and 1989. And so coffee is massively popular in Iceland, and it's customary to offer people a cup of coffee if they arrive in your house, and you tend to say 10 drops or 2 dropar as your reply is like, oh, a little is their version of a little cup. But because alcohol was banned, you just drank loads of coffee for most of the 20th century.
Does that mean there were Icelandic speakeasies and there was like an Icelandic Al Capone who was hiding hiding booze inside cartons of smoked fish?
Al Capone's not here. Yeah.
Kippers, yeah.
In the geezers. The geezers are just like leftover massive coffee pots that are boiling over. No, apparently it was really patriotic to not drink alcohol because Iceland was sort of trying to gain independence from Denmark, and they associated beer with Danish people. The Danes were drinking loads of alcohol every year, like 8 times as much alcohol per person on a yearly basis than people in Iceland at the time. And so it was not the patriotic drink to drink any beer. So the Danes were smashed and the Icelanders were awake 24/7 at the start of the 20th century.
Isn't it that, because there's a lot of funny, the Danes are sort of the joke of the bunch of that. They all the others take in the Scandinavian countries always take the mick out of Danes for being the dumb ones. It's really funny to see, like, there's a very funny Icelandic comedian called Ari Eljan.
Friend of the
He's
show.
He's got some amazing routines about Danish people, but we just all think, oh, that's because we're that arrogant sort of English, sort of, you know, all Scandinavia. We think of Scandinavia as they're all the same, essentially. We've watched one Scandi noir show and we're like, yeah, I think I've got a handle on them.
Yeah, it's dark and it's full of murder. That's all we know about Scandinavia.
Yeah, that's why they've got to drink so much coffee, to watch out for the murderers.
Yeah, while they're poring over case files and drawing like red lines on a chalkboard and things like that. Newsflash, guys, that's exactly how Ireland thinks of you guys, by the way. Just FYI.
Quite right.
And newsflash for our American judges, that's how we think of all of you. So it just keeps working up the food chain. Then I before I get to my choice, I got to mention Georgian coffee houses in Georgian London, because basically coffee took off massively in London in the late 17th century and 18th century. And the coffee houses were considered like the place to go and discuss grand ideas of the time. So you have places like the Grecian Coffee House off Fleet Street, catered for the Whig Party. The Rainbow Coffee House got the French, the Freemasons and the Huguenots. Slaughter's Coffee House got the artists in because it was on St. Martin's Lane near a lot of the theatres. The British Coffee House on Cockspur Street oddly got a lot of the Scots. And so it saw a lot of the Jacobite rebellions being plotted there. And then you had places like Moll King's Coffee House in Covent Garden, which sounds great, because Moll King was basically, she was a moll. She was a sex worker and a pimp. And so her place was for the slightly lower classes. And while the coffee house would be a place where clients would meet prostitutes, they also, she and a lot of her clients spoke a slang called flash talk. So you go into these coffee houses and there'd be languages and dialects being spoken that nobody could understand because they were distinct nearly to that particular establishment, which is quite cool. I really like reading about Moll King. She left all her money to her son. She died quite wealthy. She had two or three houses. Her son inherited her money. He was described as a very hopeful young fellow and on whom she had bestowed a liberal education at Eton School, which is the school that's provided us with many of the prime ministers of this country. And one of the most famous coffee houses of all is Lloyd's Coffee House, opened by Edward Lloyd on Tower Street in 1686. And that's the origin of Lloyd's of London, the massive insurance company that insures a lot of shipping. So if this is a place, it was near the docks. A lot of sailors and merchants and ship owners would drink there. So a lot of shipping news would reliably be circulated because they were the primary sources. And so eventually this guy Lloyd was publishing like a newspaper based in the coffee house, and they would start holding sales of maritime equipment and ships, candle auctions they were called, where people would bid for as long as it took a candle to go out, until they eventually moved about 100 years later to a dedicated building. So yeah,
I've just read a really good book that I annoyingly can't remember the name of or the author, but it's basically 50 economic 50 things that have shaped the modern economy. And one of them is about, it's one of them's insurance, the invention of insurance. It talks about Lloyd's Coffee House and how maritime insurance came out of wages, like just sat around with coffee. It was people basically, because there was obviously a lot of ships sunk back then and there was piracy and things like that, and a lot of it was basically, I bet you that my ship will make it from there to here. And somebody would take the bet. And that's how insurance essentially started.
Just to take you up on that, Carl, that was Tim Harford. I have him on my feed right here. So I listen to him every week. He's fantastic.
The book's great. And it talks, it gives you little things that have just shaped the modern economy and things sometimes that you wouldn't even expect, you know. And I really recommend the book.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I don't know if you enjoy drinking the Georgian coffee at the time. A lot of it had isinglass in it, which is a collagen produced from the swim bladders of fish.
It's still in loads of beers.
Yeah.
It's in Cronenberg, 1664.
Is that part of your vegan knowledge base that you have to have? Like you're like,
no, it's part of my medieval upbringing.
Yeah.
it's a vegan thing. You learn to look out for it because, like, yeah, certain beers I have to avoid. Carling, can't drink that. Most hipster, like, craft beers tend to be brewed in a much more sort of artisan, sort of smaller way, so they don't use it. It's normally big, big breweries that use it.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be a wrench to have to let go of that pint of Carling.
How I miss a cool cup of Carling on a summer's day.
There were about 550 coffee houses in London by the middle of the 18th century, but they'd dwindled by the time of the end of the century, basically because the people who did business there decided they were getting infiltrated by the lower classes, so they gave way to gentlemen's clubs. Where you had to like pay for membership and stuff. But they were revived in the Victorian era by the temperance movement, because obviously alcoholism and gin had then taken hold. So they thought, oh, you know what? Maybe we should bring back the coffee houses so the drinking classes might, get control of themselves. But I am going to put forward as the world's worst coffee Starbucks. It seems only right that we put them up there. Yeah, David and Tyler are punching the air. I hope not many of your neighbors, work for them or involved in the business at all. But to be fair, nobody knows exactly where they're based. So they may have been founded in Seattle, but for all we know...
Their tax base is in Atlantis now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. That's why the mermaid's on the logo. Yeah. she's their accountant. I'll talk about her in a second. But yeah, in 2018, they only paid £18.3 million in tax in Europe against paying £348 million in dividends to their parent company in Seattle. In fact, between 1998 and 2012, they had only paid £8.6 million in taxes on £3 billion in earnings in the UK. So that's 14, 15 years, tiny, tiny scrap. So not exactly ingratiating themselves to us. But a little bit about where they came from. They were founded by three people who didn't have an MBA between them, according to this article. A writer, a history teacher, and an English teacher. And they opened their first Starbucks in Pike Place Market in Seattle. It only sold coffee. It only sold the beans at first. So they didn't even start selling actual drink. Mm. And it was going to be called Cargo House initially. And then they considered it calling it Pequod after the ship in Moby Dick. And then they brought in a brand consultant called Terry Heckler. He didn't like that name. And so he had this idea about there being power words.
Terry Heckler.
Yeah.
Sorry. As a stand-up comedian, if I saw that name on a ticket list for my show, I would be so scared.
Yeah, I just keep throwing out ideas and Terry keeps shooting them down.
That sounds like a joke name you'd call somebody who pitched in a couple of times during your gig. You'd be like, all right, Terry Heckler.
It's got real sort of alt-right Twitter name about it as well, doesn't it? Terry Heckler 8473.
Yeah. Barry Shoutout.
All right, mate.
Terry thought that he believed in a thing called power words. So words which have a particular powerful, impactful sound. And so he thought words beginning with an ST were really good. So he made a list of them. And he brought in a map one day which had a place called Starbows written on it, an old map. And that made one of the founders think of Starbuck, from who's the chief mate on the Pequod in the book Moby Dick.
I mean, according to that theory, the president of every country should be called Steve.
Steve President.
Or Stuart.
Or Stuart.
Yeah.
With their chief communications officer, Barry Shoutout. Yeah. And the leader of the opposition, Terry Hatcher. The logo, the mermaid logo they have, or she's a siren, I think she's meant to be. She's meant to lure you in to buy coffee. Yeah, the original logo, her boobs are very much on show, but very much around the side of her chest. There's like they're sort of growing out sideways, and she's holding her two fishtails like out to the side, so it looks like she is, for want of a better image, spreading her legs while topless. And they've basically just zoomed the whole profile in to the new logo, so you can't really see any of that. That changed in 1992. They made it, and they put hair over her breasts in the late 80s. But yeah, CIA Langley, their campus, has its own Starbucks. They're not allowed to call out the name of the person who ordered a coffee.
Oh, what?
They do very particular background checks on the bristles who work there, and literally, because it's meant to be top secret over there, they can't shout out the names of the people who've ordered coffee. Although, presumably, being Starbucks, they'd have said it wrong anyway, so...
Yes.
The perfect cover. Yeah. And finally, the last thing I want to say about Starbucks is that they had a record label. They bought a company called Hear Music in 1999, which is a catalog company, so that owned the back catalog of a lot of singers. So they, in 2005, for example, they sold an acoustic version of Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette's album, exclusively in Starbucks outlets because they owned this back catalog. But then in 2007, they added a record label, which they called Hear Music. So the idea was they'd have in-store sales of CDs and Starbucks exclusives and branded stores, which would be places you could go and listen to these tracks and make your own mixtapes and stuff. And their first signing was Paul McCartney.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he left EMI to join this coffee
Starbucks
company.
Yeah.
And they followed him up with Joni Mitchell. She released her first album for 10 years, and Carly Simon released her first album for 8 years.
Then, knowing your history with the Beatles, that's gotta sting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really hurts. Although, you know, if he'd been alive, then John Lennon would have joined Costa's record label just to spite.
East Coast, West Coast, like, yeah, sort of battle.
Exactly. And Ringo would be signed to Nescafe, obviously.
Yeah.
George Harrison wouldn't touch any of them at the barge pole because he was the best one.
Yeah, exactly. At least they're having a nice bit of Darjeeling playing the sitar, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they didn't last very long. The record label closed after, I think, less than a year. But yeah, I just think as the omnipresent, all-knowing, all-seeing eye that hovers over every high street and side street and retail outlet and airport, you can't go anywhere but for a Starbucks sign. It's become worryingly ubiquitous. And yet somehow they keep making a loss. I don't understand that.
Poor guy. They'll catch a break soon, I reckon.
Yeah, they'll get a break.
They pumped it all into the record label.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a coffee snob, like proper snob. And I didn't used to be. I married a woman from Melbourne. My wife, as she's known. So I don't want to describe her in such weird terms. But what I'm saying is she's from Melbourne. And Melbourne is like their most hip city in the world. Mm. Like I'd never really experienced coffee as, they call it third wave coffee, which sounds a bit sort of undermines third wave feminism a bit, but
that's why the mermaid covered her breasts. First it was about liberating them, and now she's got to, you know, reclaim that and control it.
But third wave coffee is what I think about as coffee, because like there was the boom of second wave coffee, but what was your Starbucks and all your high street coffee shops, and suddenly it was your mum going, oh, I had a cappuccino, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas third wave coffee is coffee being taken seriously as a genuine, like wine. Different beans create different tastes and all that. And I didn't know about that until I went to Melbourne. And then I found out about third wave coffee, and I got well into coffee and actually started tasting it rather. I stopped having milk in it. You know, I started only drinking like individually filtered coffee. And like, once I got into it, I really sort of found how different it all is. So that's why I became a snob, and now I can't drink any of that Starbucks stuff. And now I always make my coffee in the morning. It's quite a big process. But there is my the worst coffee, and I don't think it's the worst because I'm never going to taste it on principle. Because this sort of coffee gets a bit of flat. It's the sort of thing whenever you see a politician go, well, bloody, you know, maybe the millennials could afford a house if they didn't spend £4 a day on coffee, that sort of thing. In Melbourne, my favourite coffee shop in Melbourne, or cafe, and it does food, it's called Monk Bodhi Dharma. It's one of the best places in the world, like I think, for food and drink. They have a coffee on their menu that is a $150 pour over.
What?
And it made the news when it went on the menu. It was national news in Australia because it came at the time when there was this whole bloody, well, maybe they could buy a house if they weren't eating smashed avocados every day. And it caught a wave and became this symbol of everything that's wrong with our generation, of like that spending money on frivolities rather than sort of saving for the future. So even though it's my favorite coffee shop and I go there and I sort of anytime I'm in Melbourne I sort of live there essentially, it's I think that they've really made that annoys me to the point that I'm like, what you've done there is you've given ammunition to assholes, essentially. Yeah. And it takes away from the fact that I think it makes a novelty of good coffee, because I love it and I think it should be taken seriously. And I sort of, but that I think makes people think, oh, it's all nonsense and it's spending money. It's bloody coffee, mate. You just drink it, innit? Doesn't matter what it tastes like.
It feels like a really good way of like weeding out the arseholes, though.
I mean, there is
have someone there who's like the arsehole monitor, who anytime someone orders that coffee, they go, sorry.
Yeah.
I've just heard what the phrase I just said back to myself. And yeah, but like as soon as you see someone orders that coffee, they go, of course, sir, let us take you into the back room where the coffee is served. Line up against the wall, please. This is open your mouth, close your eyes, bullet to the back of the throat.
Yeah. I suppose that's it. Anyone who's like, anyone who's suddenly going to write a think piece in the Spectator about it, it's you know, right, they're out of the run, like, they're arseholes.
Yeah.
Anyone who actually purchases it, you basically yeah. manage to find the thing that will link the two groups. Everyone else who goes, I like the coffee, but I'm not that mad.
That's gone. They've done the classic thing you do with wine, where you do the really low, $1.50 coffee.
Yeah.
The $4 coffee and then the $150 coffee. So everyone's going to buy the $4 coffee instead of the really cheap one.
Yeah. It's still on there. Every year I go to Melbourne, it's sitting there at the bottom. It annoys me. I'm like, just get rid of it. I don't want it there.
Is it not taunting you a little bit?
Of course it is. Because I know, I mean, there is every part of me wants to know, why is it so expensive? I want to drink it. I want to drink the forbidden coffee. But I can't because I hate it.
Why do they claim it's worth it?
Oh, I can't remember. Hang on, I'll tell you, let me Google it.
It's not one of those it's made good. Filtered through elephant dung or one of those.
No.
I would imagine when you drink it, you do the coffee equivalent of Popeye when he has his tin of spinach.
I've just Googled, and the top story on Google about it is from the Daily Mail Online. So here we go. The coffee that costs $150. A hipster cafe sells brews in glass goblets for an outrageous price because people will pay anything for a cool Instagram story.
They're very pleased with their use of the word goblet there to make them sound like an Anglo-Saxon king chugging back a brew.
The coffee beans are from Jose Alfredo's number 227. Limited batch.
That's a really good batch, though.
I remember.
It's a really good batch.
It's a limited batch of coffee that sells for $5,000 a kilogram at auction. Wow.
But I'm not a coffee auction?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I haven't been, but I imagine people at a coffee auction are going to be some of the twitchiest bidders on earth.
Yeah, they think they're bidding all the time, but actually just people really alert.
Yeah, it should really have only sold for a couple of hundred quid, but they just kept bidding.
Wow, that's amazing. To be fair, I did read one Australian coffee story. In 2015, Serena Williams was playing tennis against Flavia Panetta in the Hoffman Cup in Perth. She lost the first set, 6-love, was whitewashed. And she decided she was in need of a coffee. So she ordered a coffee on court, had an espresso, checked with the umpire that it was all right, that it wasn't a banned stimulant or anything, had her espresso, and then recovered to win love 6-6-3-6-love.
That is, imagine being that opponent. You just believe it.
Imagine also being Serena Williams, that you're that cool and you're that amazing.
You
could order a coffee and people, if one of us was playing tennis, we ordered coffee, people are like, all right, you wanker.
Serena
Williams does, and you go, oh my god, she's a goddess.
Yeah.
I'd like to hope she gave the cup and saucer to one of the ball girls at the back of the court who holds her towels. So
played a shot.
Yeah.
Sip.
Just. New beans, please.
So obviously this is a coffee that you've not tasted, Carl.
I know it's not. I mean, because basically if I had to just pick my worst coffee, it would be a Nescafe sort of just jar instant teaspoon. That stuff, I cannot even understand how anyone could drink it. And then it would be your bad. Do you know what? I'll tell you what it would be, and this sounds pretentious, but a sort of English town, local coffee shop cappuccino. That.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the sort of one where they're like, do you want some chocolate on top? And you're like, oh, I want you to pour it down the toilet, mate. Because they think. It's that thing, it's just frothy milk with a little bit of coffee in it.
Yeah, it's mostly
nothing.
Froth.
You know, I'm not saying, not having a go. I know Italian coffee is different. I love an espresso when it's done well. A bad espresso is horrendous, but yeah, I've got a real, in terms of taste hatred, it would be that milky, horrible coffee, instant coffee, your Starbucks type, just sort of mass made, sort of get it in and out. I want a coffee that's taken a bit of time to make.
That Italian thing is really interesting because the guys I think it was Howard Schultz and the Starbucks guys basically went to Italy, drank a load of coffee, and then invented the term venti and grande and all of that stuff because they thought it just made it sound cool in Italian.
Yeah.
because instead of just saying small, medium, large, they've gone, oh, well, we'll make up these Italian terms, and like, as if this is how they do it in Italy all the time.
Did you? I used to, back in the day, before when I did drink a sort of Starbucks and that, before I discovered third wave coffee, I used to, on principle, not say the names. I used to say small, medium, large. And yeah. I didn't do it to be rude. I just was like, can I just say what I want? You'll understand the terminology. And I only ever had one person get a bit funny about it and sort of say it's actually grande, you know. Yeah. And I was like, most of them would understand. Sense.
Like, grande's the small one. That really annoys me.
And all of them are too big. That's how you know it's bad coffee. No, like, the large one shouldn't be a litre. It's not, you know, coffee. Like, if you go to a good coffee shop, it would be like 6 ounce, 8 ounce, like the actual coffee sizes. The biggest one would be smaller than the smallest Starbucks because it is a stimulant at the end of the day. You're meant to, and it's meant to taste nice. You don't need a lot of it. So I really resent that, you know, the massive Starbucks type coffees.
Yeah, 6 to 8 ounces is meant to be the ideal amount.
Yeah.
In fact, the golden ratio of coffee is apparently 1 ounce of coffee to 18 ounces of it's 1 to 18, 1 or 2 tablespoons of ground coffee for every 6 ounces of water.
The golden ratio, was that discovered by Leonardo da Vinci? I mean,
that's... It wasn't da Vinci, it was Leonardo da Venti.
Unbelievable.
Oh, God.
It's amazing he could draw those pictures so well. Hand was shaking all over the place.
Vitruvian Man is doing loads of star jumps because he's so alert.
Yeah. I'm going to get this out of the way early doors. Carl has already alluded to the fact that our generation has hoisted upon its shoulders both coffees and our predilection for avocados are why we are so economically weak and bringing down the economic infrastructure as we know it. So let me introduce you, gentlemen, to the aberration that is the avo latte.
And God, I don't know everything about this already.
Yeah. And I don't know whether this is baristas ironically trying to take on the Daily Mail in its own game, but it's what you think it is. It is an avocado skin with the avocado scooped out and a high-end coffee poured in, with complete with coffee art.
Yeah, Ben, please follow me into this back room. This is... Close your eyes up against the wall.
I'd love to hope that you can get an espresso avo latte where they just remove the avocado stone, pop it in the divot.
Is it? But it is actual coffee, though. That's...
Yep.
Is that another? You just reminded me of one of my other big bugbears in coffee is when they a sort of a brunch spot will have, they'll have their coffee menu and it's got all the coffees, and then it's got like a turmeric latte or a matcha latte. You look at the ingredients and it's milk frothed with turmeric, and it's like, there's no coffee in there.
Yeah.
Like, don't sell it as if, don't put it on the coffee menu, put it on the flipping milkshake menu, whatever. I get really annoyed that it's snuck in on a technicality.
to be fair, if I'm in that branding meeting, they go, okay, how are we going to sell all this excess turmeric and milk?
Yeah. It's
branding it a turmeric latte is a much better strategy than a turmeric milkshake.
Have you ever had a matcha latte?
No.
Matcha latte is green matcha tea powder and frothy milk, and it is disgusting. It's like drinking
that's a 600% markup right there, Carl.
Yeah,
on matcha. Oh yeah, definitely. It's
put it on the coffee then.
Yeah, coffee over tea. Yeah, you're right.
I hate it, and it just tastes like you're drinking sort of pond water. And you've been convinced that you're drinking a healthy coffee. It's like you're not even in the same ballpark, mate.
It looks like the sort of thing that hipster alchemists drink.
A film.
To be fair, in my head I was imagining a frothy avocado, so what you've described, Ben, is only slightly less horrific.
That sounds like hipster receptacles. That's like when you go to a hipster cafe and you ask for your food and it comes out in a, you know, a shoe or something.
Yeah. a cigar box from the 1940s.
Yeah. I don't know if you know comedian Danny McLaughlin. I once went for lunch with him, and he hates hipster receptacles for any food. Like, I on principle, just will not eat out of it. And they brought his chips in like a little weird red basket. And she was only like, the poor waitress, like, she just put it down and went, "There's your chips." And he went, "Yeah, can you take that back, please, and put it on a plate?" And she was like, "What?" And he went, "Can you take it back and put it on a plate, please? I don't eat out of baskets." And she thought he was joking and laughed. And he went, "No, I'm serious. I'm not having a go at you. You've not, you know, it's not, you've not done it. I'm just saying, can you take it back and tell them I want to eat my food off a plate?" And she was so shy and like, "Okay."
How does Danny do with picnics?
Badly. He's ruined a lot of them, to be honest.
Can I ask Tyler? When I was young, I wasn't allowed to have coffee up until, like, you have to be like late teenager for your parents even allow you to have coffee. David, not casting any aspersions on you whatsoever, but Tyler, you can speak openly now. At what age were you first allowed to have coffee?
Well, I don't really like coffee.
Excellent.
The aftertaste is kind of gross. I like tea better. So,
excellent. Man after my own heart. Did your parents ever try and get you to drink a baby Chino? Because that is a hate crime.
No.
Again, it's not a coffee. Don't put it on a coffee menu. Have a side kids thing where it's called hot milk.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about how guilty I am of serving those to my child every single day.
If you're not serving it under the guise, you're not saying to your kids, "Well, who wants your coffee?" you're not wearing an apron and sort of doing it like you're in a coffee shop.
Hey, listen, toddlers love role play, mate.
You've got to buy into the fantasy.
After I got over that Avo Latte aberration, I looked at famous coffee consumers and people who consumed a lot of coffee. Beethoven famously thought that it was the source of a lot of his inspiration, but he was Germanically particular about the amount of coffee. He insisted there was exactly 60 beans per coffee, no more, no less. But he was an amateur compared to the French writer Balzac.
Yeah.
And Balzac was about, I didn't know this about him, was like a real frenzied writer. So he'd go to sleep at 6 in the evening after dinner, wake up at 1 in the morning, write for 7 hours, have a little 90-minute nap at 8 in the morning, and then write again from 9:30 to 4 p.m. And to make sure he could keep up that routine when he wrote, he drank as many as 50 cups of coffee a day. I'm not going to suggest the two are connected, but when he died, aged 51, he was said to be suffering stomach cramps, facial twitches, headaches, high blood pressure, and eventually he died of heart failure.
Yeah.
So that all adds up on CSI Enlightenment France, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can grind him up and put him straight back in the coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he's in the $150 cup.
That's what it is. It's powdered Balzac.
Yeah. I also found a cracking quote. There's a Hungarian mathematician called Paul Erdős, who he came up with something called the Erdős number, which is essentially the posh mathematical version of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Obviously, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon is how many links between you and people you know till you get to the film star Kevin Bacon. The Erdős number was how many mathematicians have you studied with before you connect to someone who studied with Erdős. He also came up with a bunch of other theorems that were a lot less self-serving, but he loved caffeine and amphetamines, and his quote
sleepy fellow was he.
Yeah, his quote, which I love, is, "A mathematician is a machine for turning coffee into theorems."
Oh yeah, I have seen that one. That's very good. But then again, to be fair, if you're a mathematician, you've got an infinite number of numbers to count through, so you need to be awake.
Yeah
I think that's what he spent most of his life doing.
Yeah. Yes, he was basically a Hungarian version of the Count.
Yeah.
You talked about Brazil being an enormous exporter of coffee. I found an amazing story about the 1932 Olympics. So obviously 1932, height of the Great Depression, and Brazil was unable to send its athletes to Los Angeles. It couldn't afford to. So here's what they did. They got a ship.
They loaded it up with 69 athletes, and behind them they loaded 50,000 sacks of Brazilian coffee. And they told the athletes, if you want to go to the Olympics, you have to sell this coffee so that you can afford the ticket. And
I thought you were going to say they loaded them up with coffee and made them run across the ocean.
Yes.
Power the boat.
Yeah, power the boat.
Yeah, and then they broke every record going once they got there.
Did they do it?
Once they got to LA, the port authorities charged them $1 per person to disembark. That's about $17.50 today. And they hadn't made enough money so the whole team could disembark. So there were 15 athletes who never made it off the ship because they couldn't sell enough coffee to get them to the Olympics.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And when they failed to sell enough in LA, the ship went up the coast to San Francisco and they made a bit more extra revenue and they got off the boat. And my favourite part of the story was there was an athlete called Adalberto Cardozo and he was scheduled to run the 10,000 meters. He sold enough coffee to get his way off the boat. He then hitchhiked his way from San Francisco to LA, made it to the venue just in time to do the 10,000 meters and finished the race barefoot. He came last. I'm so sorry it doesn't get the cool runnings ending.
I mean, my suspicions were raised when you said when he had a long distance to go that he took, you know, hitchhiking rather than actually bothering to run it there and taking the time to train.
Yeah.
That was the giveaway. I love the fact that they, presumably, did they go with the coffee on the ship?
Yeah.
So were they still like trying to sell it to passengers on the way over?
It's got a real sort of Brewster's Millions vibe to it, doesn't it?
You've got 40 days to sell all of this coffee. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. I then looked into two of the things before my suggestion. You talked about Pope Clement and people in Europe in the Renaissance wanting to outlaw coffee. Probably the angriest royal leader against coffee was the Ottoman Emperor Murad IV. He really didn't like coffee. Similar to a lot of the Catholic Church, he believed that coffee intoxicated drinkers. That was made it forbidden, according to the Quran. It was bad for the body, forbidden. And apparently roasting it, the way they roasted it at the time, made it the equivalent of charcoal. And apparently you're not allowed to eat charcoal.
No barbecues.
No barbecues. If you get indigestion, bad luck. The Quran says that is haram, not for you. There's may well have been political reasons for it. So in the Muslim world, obviously, the main forum and gathering place for people was mosques. But at the mosque, you're not going to get involved in any worldly or political chit-chat. Now, in Europe, where are you going to get involved in that sort of talk? It's going to be down at the tavern where you will plan political opposition or uprisings. No taverns in the Muslim world, or if they are, very, very much underground and have got the Muslim equivalent of Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis playing jazz in the corner. So instead, coffee houses, when they emerged, they were seen as being like these potential for dissent. And so people like Murad decided he had to clamp down on them. Particularly, there's a type of Ottoman soldier called a janissary.
I think we've mentioned them on the show before.
Yeah, they're sort of halfway. They're like an armed civil servant, essentially.
Yeah.
And yeah, brutal letter openers. They were connected to these coffee houses. In fact, some coffee houses were so connected to janissaries that they had the janissary insignia as their signage. So no sort of sexy mermaids, instead like a Turkish dude with a hole punch. So that's the background. So not only did Murad ban coffee and ban these coffee houses, these were the penalties for if you were found drinking coffee in the Ottoman Empire in the 1620s. First offence, a beating. Second offence, you were sewn in a leather bag and thrown into the Bosphorus. But sometimes the Ottoman emperor took it into his own hands and would stalk the streets of Istanbul in disguise, whipping out a 100-pound broadsword to decapitate whoever he found drinking coffee.
Wow.
You have to really want a coffee. to take that risk.
Yeah, yeah.
To be fair, that coffee must have been really good. Yeah.
That's what's on offer in Melbourne, mate.
Yeah, yeah. You drink it and an Ottoman emperor will cut your head off, but the coffee's really good.
No, you drink it and Paul Hogan turns up going, that's not a coffee, mate.
Call that a broadsword. This is a broadsword.
The other royal who hated coffee was King Gustav III of Sweden. And in the 18th century, he wanted to test his theorem that coffee was a dangerous stimulant. So he set up an experiment by order of the crown to test it. What he did is he got scientists to basically do a control experiment to find out how dangerous coffee was. And they found a pair of identical twins who were convicted murderers who were condemned to death.
I love medieval Sweden.
But mate, this isn't medieval Sweden. This is Enlightenment Sweden.
Oh, Enlightenment Sweden, excuse me, yes.
Yes. And he said, listen, lads, we're not going to kill you. You're just in prison for life. But here's what you got to do. Twin A, you have to drink 3 pots of coffee a day. Twin B, you have to drink 3 pots of tea a day. And we are going to test if it changes either of your behaviours.
Oh, my God. It's the preamble of the Coke versus Pepsi test.
Yeah. And I'd love to tell you that in the end, the coffee drinker became a crazed maniac and the tea drinker kept reciting the laws of cricket over and over. But it proved inconclusive. The only thing we can prove is that drinking tea and coffee perhaps gives you a long life, because the two prisoners outlasted both Gustav III, who was assassinated in 1792, and both of their doctors as well.
That's a pretty good deal. If you're on death row and they go, look, we're going to keep you alive, but we're also going to give you a lovely pot of coffee every 4 hours and, just fill your boots.
Yeah, you've been upgraded to room service.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out exactly how they conducted this experiment fully. I mean, do they just issue them out into the streets and say, have fun, boys. You know, we'll keep tabs on you in the background. Like, how did the inquest, you know, happen after that? Well, they only killed 2 people after we released them.
No, I reckon. So, yeah. I reckon they got 2 more murderers and made them their butlers. And yeah. then those murderers were like, well, we obviously need an under butler. And eventually, the entire death row was empty because they'd all given jobs down the tree to each other.
Imagine they're identical twins. Imagine they, like, every day in the yard, they'd just swap over.
Yeah.
And they were both just getting 1.5 pots each.
The triplet was like, oh, I want to do the hot chocolate one, please. Yeah.
But I am staying in Sweden for my choice of the world's worst coffee, and it is a North Scandinavian delicacy called kaffiost. Kaffiost contains something called Ystoleipa. And Ystoleipa, it's rich, it's moist, it's made by reindeers, and it's cheese.
Ugh.
Oh my God!
What kaffiost is a classic Scandinavian dark black coffee that I'm sure Carl is whetting his appetite over. And in it, they dunk a fermented, dry cheese bread.
Oh, no.
Because they do affogato in Italy. It's like they put ice cream in it, isn't it?
But that... Oh, yeah, affogato. But that's sort of like a pudding, where you have like a chocolate...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah. Then you do the cheese course.
Yeah.
But it's for the sort of nutters that get a cheese board over a dessert. That's what it is. Instead, the people that don't want a cake, I just want some cheese in coffee.
Yeah.
It's you're in a rush. It's a cheese board to go. Our choices for the world's worst coffee, which Dave and Tyler now have to weigh up, are...
Really intimidatingly, they're scribbling loads of notes. I've seen like an A4 pad. There's colour coding going on.
Well, even more awkwardly, I imagine they're going to go and retire to a different room and do a taste test, come back wearing a cap and gown.
Two highly caffeinated men.
Yes. So they have to choose Dean Barry's suggestion of the classic evil empire of Starbucks, Carl's suggestion of the Melbournian $150 coffee, or mine of Scandinavia's cheesy bet noir, kaffeost with Justolepa in it. Gentlemen, what are your thoughts?
You've given us a bit of a poser here, gentlemen.
Good.
I'm trying to hew as closely as possible to the theme of the show, heroic failure. And so I'm trying to weigh each of these. We are trying to weigh each of these on that particular merit. I am not a coffee snob, but I do enjoy a cup or four a day. And I have a very nice, basic drip machine that I use every day. I do use a Scandinavian brand as my coffee. When we went to Costa Rica, we picked up the Choreador, which is the Costa Rican like drip machine, basically.
Wow.
And that's one of my favorite coffee tools. I love that one. But let's go through the ranks here, inspecting the ranks. I'm really torn here. I just have to say. So Starbucks, Barrett.
Tyler, presumably when the world returns to normal, you're gonna need summer jobs. You don't want a bad man to Starbucks too early.
No. We're trying to stick to heroic failure, right? So
yeah.
It's really tough to put Starbucks in the bucket of heroic failure. The one main experience I remember with Starbucks, I don't know if you're all familiar with the Christopher Guest movie, Best in Show.
Yes.
Yeah. Right? Like the Crufts kind of equivalent, that kind of thing. They made a reference. One of the couples met at Starbucks, but it wasn't at the same Starbucks. It was a Starbucks that was opposite the street, and they saw each other through the window at a different Starbucks, right? So I have a similar story. When I first moved up here, my friend who was working at another company, she said, "Hey, I haven't seen you in years. Let's get together. I'll meet you at Starbucks. I'm sorry. Well, come again. I'll meet you at Starbucks. So this was the Starbucks headquarters. Of course, they have a massive Starbucks, like they're one of their flagship stores in the ground floor of the Starbucks. So it's the Starbucks at Starbucks, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, Barry. I can't classify that in the heroic failure bucket.
That's fine. Tyler, it feels like Starbucks belongs in the episode with Donald Trump, where we put all the people who are too bad to ever win episodes.
There you are.
Trump, Starbucks, and Hitler. They're all in the same alternate universe.
We're really wrestling. We have a split vote here. We'll put it that way. So, Ben, Tyler is rooting very heavily for Caféost. Because, quote, even though he doesn't drink coffee, you don't put cheese in coffee.
Kids say the darndest things.
Yeah. I'm fully on board with that. I mean, you know, I could see Carl's face scrunching up in fear and loathing as you were describing that, Ben.
I mean, that's a motto for life, I think, that.
Yeah.
It should be on a wooden board sold on Etsy.
It should be inscribed on tablets of stone, mate.
So yeah, we're still processing right now, but that's got one vote. We'll see if we can close the gap here between us. Carl, yes. Really appreciated your suggestion of the milky, horrible candy coffee, you know, sold at local, you know, village coffee shops, because it hits that heroic failure sweet spot. They're trying so hard and they're so proud that they can't quite get it across the line, right? What do you say, Tyler? You get the tiebreaker.
I don't know, because you shouldn't put cheese in coffee.
You shouldn't put cheese in coffee. I don't know why we're having this debate.
Now
you've said it. You know what, Tyler? We're such idiots. We could have had this debate like over in 2 minutes. It would have been the shortest podcast ever if Ben had just said, "Listen, guys, cheese and coffee." We'd have gone, "Oh yeah, fair enough."
Yeah, it's lovely, Tyler. It was like your dad was going, "Should you put a fork in the electricity socket?" No. No, Dad. No, no, you should not.
Tyler, this was a test the whole time. To see how well you've been raised, and you've passed.
I think that has got to be our submission, our vote.
Very good.
Caféost I thought, you know, for a second there, Ben, I thought it was going to be like the Scandinavian equivalent of civet coffee, where first you have to ship the reindeer over to Guatemala, have them eat the coffee, ship them all the way back.
Yeah, reindeer has the time of your life, but the coffee is just not worth it. Excellently well judged and chosen, gentlemen. Just before we nip off, it's time for the world's best news of the week, and we shall continue pumping out good news until this pandemic is over. And we go to Chicago, where I have found the most ingenious manner of all time of calling dibs on a parking space. I don't know what it's like where you lads live, but here in London it can often be high noon to try and get a parking space. Chicago at the moment, there are sub-zero temperatures, so what a local gentleman called Adam Seltzer has done is soak his jeans in water, take the jeans outside, hold them up until the jeans freeze, and then leave them there overnight as though the invisible man is holding a parking space for him.
That is so good.
It looks incredible.
That's like a piece of art.
Yeah. It really is. And what he does know is obviously the modern reproduction of The Invisible Man, I think, starred Kevin Bacon. And so Kevin Bacon once a week will go and stand in there, and they're 1 degree away from him.
Yeah.
Before we go, Carl, where can our listeners find you, and what can they find you doing when they get there?
They can find my podcast. It's just called TVI now. We've just sort of abbreviated it down because it's easier for people to find. So it's TVI, and that's me and Julian Dean just chatting every once a week. We just released our 100th episode last week with Al Murray, which was good fun.
Oh, nice.
And
Al Murray is not a vegan, is he?
We don't have it because we're vegans, but we realize we never ever get vegans on it. And we 95% of the time don't mention veganism. So that's why we thought, let's abbreviate it, because two vegan idiots makes it sound like it's about veganism. So we thought we'd miss selling the podcast. So yeah, it's just TVI. It's just funny, inane chat. And then people can find me on social media at Carl Donnelly on all of them.
Smashing stuff. Well, thank you very much, Carl. Thank you, Dave and Tyler, for your excellent judgments. We're all off to our local branch of Starbucks to try and sneak a bit of Wensleydale into the lattes. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.